try the Aging Well Together show, and we were trying to multitask and test some mics beforehand, but we might just do it during the show because we are super excited to get involved to start our 86th Aging Well Together show. I know Alicia's already done a big smile. We're legit now. I don't know when we hit legit. I think it was after our 50th show that we're like, these are real numbers now. But Rocco, if we're listening, Rocco has over 1,000 shows. So yeah, we're not gonna be able to catch him here. I'm turning all the mics on just to see which one will work for us. All right, we have got to get into our show. I was finally able, this has taken a while, to get my longtime friend and colleague, Dr. Nathan Boucher, on the show. So excited to talk to him, and I've already given him a hard time because he's got all kinds of fantastic titles and capacities over at Duke, which I warned him I would be both respectful. Yeah, he's putting his thumbs down and disrespectful, but he will explain how he's also connected to UNC. So, but he really does wonderful things at Duke. So I can't, even though I am obnoxiously giving him a hard time, for those who don't know, as a double Tar Heel and being in our area, 3 minutes away from the University of North Carolina, we always have to give a hard time. But I know Nathan does so much within the Duke Health System and the Duke VA, Veterans Administration. Yep.
The latter,
Veterans Administration and Duke University. Dr. Boucher, though quickly I'm going to just call him Nathan, brings a rare mix of experience working at the intersection of public policy and medicine and all kinds of community health through both practice and research and teaching. And he has spent years working closely with both professionals and everyday people in the community. So I'm so excited to dive into it with him, learn so much, pepper him with lots of questions. But as always, before we do that, we have to give a shout out, and we are overjoyed to give a shout out to WCOM LP Chapel Hill Carrboro for hosting our weekly Aging Well Together show. As you all know, if you are our longtime listeners, you can catch our show every Thursday from 2 to 3, often live. If you are in a small signal strength area, you can catch us on 103.5 FM, or anywhere in the world, you can stream us live at WCOMFM.org. The Aging Well Together show is brought to you by the fantastic, wonderful Orange County Department on Aging. And I will take an aside to say it is August 20th. Well, I shouldn't say what date it is. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway.
In case you're recording, in case you're listening.
No, I was like, wait, I'm about to tell. This is not protected information. It's Janice Tyler's birthday today.
Janice!
Yeah, I've already been texting her.
We had a meeting and she mentioned it, though.
Did she mention it was her birthday?
Welcome to 65.
Oh, my goodness. She's amazing. So I was already texting her. Janice, if you all don't know, she's the director of the Orange County Department on Aging. She helped to launch this show, and we're going to have her on for our 100th show, whether she likes it or not.
Well, happy birthday.
So happy birthday, Janice, if you're listening. And besides being our... Oh, do you want me to do
give
it?
Give something.
Gosh,
give something.
Wait. Hold on.
Janice. I was in here.
And then like the... of all these things. You know, Alicia, I keep bringing this red sound box and it has no off. And when I come, all of a sudden, as I was, what's the one? I'm trying to find the one that I keep hearing. This I keep hearing. And that'll be as I'm walking and I look around to see who's doing that to me. And I realize it's me every time it hits against me. I'm whistling to myself. Anyway, the Orange County Department on Aging is amazing. Besides being our sponsors and expert guests on the show, Marilyn, the communications manager, is amazing about, I keep saying amazing, posting our shows, which turns into podcasts. So if you miss us listening to us live, or you love us so much you want to hear the show again, feel free to go to the website, Orange County. I'll tell you right now, www.orangecountync.gov/aging, and all the website on the website. Not only can you get linked to our previous shows, aka our podcasts, but you can also find a host of fantastic Orange County resources. It really is a great website. If you want to go old school and call the Orange County Department on Aging to get any services or supports or information, feel free to give them a call at 919-968-2070. And if you have questions about our shows or want to suggest a topic, or person or organization, you can feel free to email me at agingwelltogethershow@gmail.com. That's one big smushed email, agingwelltogethershow@gmail.com. And I told Alicia last week, we are busy scheduling into 2026 now. Mm-hmm. So, yay. You heard just a little bit of music from our opening music from the Carrboro Bass Band, the Robert Bradford Quintet. Thank you so much to that phenomenal band for allowing us to use their great and original music for our opening and closing music. And my fabulous co-host, Alicia Reed, is back.
Ed McMahon. I'm hurting.
My Ed McMahon.
You don't know who that is, do you?
Yes, he's old enough to know it.
I don't know.
Nathan, we had...
much younger than your
pictures. I have a check for you.
We had a really young guest on a few months ago who not only didn't know who Ed McMahon was, didn't know who Johnny Carson was, so we had to go on a whole show tangent, and then we were just like, all right, it doesn't matter. But Alicia's my fabulous co-host. She's back with us. She is an amazing, I keep saying amazing, wellness instructor at the Orange County Department on Aging.
She allows me to be here with her. You are gorgeous.
Oh, my gosh. Are you busy showing Nathan pictures of himself and telling him how... Oh, my God. Alicia, you've taken over my stalking.
It's only on the guys.
Only on the guys. We talked about this last week with Representative Alan Boynsey, that normal people say that they do research and they do preparation for when their guests come on. But no, we say we stalk our guests.
Stalk.
Because if there's an appropriate way to say something and an inappropriate way, here on the Aging Well Together show, we try to choose the inappropriate as long as it's within FCC standards. All right. Alicia's amazing community volunteer. After we finally let Nathan speak, there may be something you're going to volunteer with after that, since he does a lot on caregiving research. So be prepared. All right. So on, and then make sure to listen right after our show is Afternoon Talk with Alicia, which is Alicia's show. And then as for me, if you haven't already figured out, I'm Heather Altman. I'm your loving host here. I've been in aging services and supports for more than 25 years in this area. I help older adults and their families connect with resources in our community. I'm a caregiver for older family members. And at 54, I'm focusing on my own changing needs. Mm-hmm. So I am super invested in how we're all aging well together. That's always how I start our show. Oh my gosh, I've been talking so much and I'm going to talk more because I have quite the introduction for the fantastic Dr. Nathan Boucher, who I'm looking at right now, who I just adore and have been wanting on this show for a while. So glad he's with us and may this be the first of many visits. Mm-hmm. Nathan will go into specifics about all I'm about to share, but my formal introduction. Nathan is a research health scientist at Durham VA Health Systems Center for Innovation to accelerate discovery and practice transformation, adapt. We could have an entire show just pulling apart that fancy sounding acronym. He's also Duke University faculty at Samford School of Public Health and the medical school and the nursing school. People say I do a lot, but he wears so much. You should see his webpage. It's ridiculous. So many titles. He's also a senior fellow at the Duke Center for the Study of Aging, Human Development, as well as a Duke Margolis Center for Health Policy core faculty. Nathan, this is just too much. You do so much. But what this means for all of us and our listeners is he has extensive experience in both clinical medicine, and he'll talk about his own work as a licensed physician assistant in critical care and emergency medicine. So he's got legit clinician stuff behind him, as well as healthcare administration, health professions, education, hospice and palliative care, quality improvement, and community-based research. All right, we are so excited to talk to Nathan, ask him about the challenges and opportunities at the intersection of social care and healthcare and how it informs research agendas, but most importantly, how your collaborations across disciplines at the VA and Duke and with community organizations have afforded you deep insights into the lives and challenges of community members and family and friend care partners. With that, welcome Nathan Boucher. Welcome. Wait, let's do this.
Welcome.
Thank you.
How is that for an introduction? All right. Before we get into the ridiculous amount of titles you have, which is super fun, we want to know all about you and your background and where you're from and how you got into just all of your work now.
I get paid for like two of those titles.
Oh, man.
I want to clarify that. That's an important distinction.
So you're an advocate for the people.
That's right. That's right. That's the one that pays the least.
Yeah. I know that. We'll talk about that afterwards over some cocktails.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for having me here today to really talk about a variety of issues. And something that immediately comes to mind is you talked about how do you translate things from the quote-unquote ivory tower to on-the-ground, community-based stuff that really matters in people's lives. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I really I tried to really make a point of taking almost all that I do kind of out and away from the ivory tower, because
thank you.
Some of the least effective things.
And not to put down your ivory tower. I mean, feel free to put in another ivory tower. No, but no. It just, especially for this kind of show and for most of the people, it's like, yeah, great, you do a lot of research. But what does that mean for us?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I try to make it as translational and policy oriented as possible.
But tell us about you. Like, how did you get into this? Are you from here?
I am not. I'm from Little Rhode Island.
Oh, you're a New England person like me.
I am.
I did not catch that. I couldn't get past all the current stuff. I didn't go deep into your past.
Oh, yeah. Quahogs, man. Yeah.
Okay,
Do you know where that is?
No, I have no idea what that is.
You don't even know where that is.
I've heard it's a small island
off the coast of Greece.
Oh, no.
Just kidding. Lying
about that.
Isle of Rhodes. No. It is a state. A small state, but lots of people.
Yes, I know, because in New England, there's a funny thing. So I'm from the Boston area, and they sort of make fun of our not really, but there's a whole thing about if New England states were siblings, like, and family members, who would they be? And Rhode Island's like the little sibling or something.
It's like the punky little brother, yeah.
Yeah, I know. But I will say, to stalk Nathan, and I invite all of our listeners to do that, all you will get is not your professional, not even your family. You will get pictures and pictures, which are gorgeous, of you being on a lake, on a body of water. You're a big boater. I tried to stay away from Facebook, but when I was on social media,
yes, that's where I was. But I am on zero social media at this point.
So you and me both. I went off at like 2 years ago, but I remember.
Wow.
Okay, so you're from Rhode Island, and now you're here.
Yeah. So both my parents were in the Air Force and then health professions, and I think that they're both veterans. So when I talk about my veteran work,
that was one of my questions. What was the connection? And you've answered it right there.
Yeah,
okay.
You're gonna see that in some of the narrative, but definitely I come from a healthcare family background. My mother was a critical care nurse. Big influence on me.
I am seeing through lines already.
Mm-hmm. Just passed away a little over a year ago.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. So big influence, really cool lady. And so I think that there's a lot of influence there. Oddly, for my undergraduate education, I focused in outdoor education. I thought I wanted to just be doing, skiing and boating and rock climbing and backpacking and all that.
That actually makes sense for the little I know about how you spend your not work time. Where'd you go undergrad?
A very small school in northern Wisconsin called Northland College.
Wow.
On the shores of Lake Kichigumi or Lake Superior.
Okay, we're getting very geographic, but now I'm seeing the through line, because I really know how much you love being out on the water. So this all makes sense. And Alicia, I already pre-warned him, and I said Alicia is all about physical fitness and staying physically active, which is an ongoing bit on this show.
She's becoming.
I'm physically active from the neck up. All right, so you're in Wisconsin, and then at some point your parents said, do some health care, get back into critical care.
No. When I was an undergraduate student, I got my EMT certification at the local community college and worked on the ambulance in the next town over.
I
spent a lot of weekends and nights over there as one of my kind of employment situations during undergrad. And when I came to the end of that, I was like, you know what? Outdoor education is probably not going to pay a whole heck of a lot in the fields.
So you'll be a health services researcher, which pays so much.
Well, that was years later even, but I worked as an EMT
amazing.
In five different states for about 12 years until I graduated from, by that point, physician assistant school in Boston. So
this is really helpful to know, because because one of my friends, one of my close friends who lives not too far away, was also an EMT at one point. Now he does computer stuff. But so he's my first person to go to when I have like a health issue or like an emergency. Like, how should I handle this? So now that I know that, I may text you and be like, I just did this. What? How do I stop the bleeding?
I have been out of clinical practice now for many years.
But once you know, you know.
But this finger right here works, and there's three numbers that I can dial very quickly for you. So, but you could do the same.
All right. So where'd you go to school in Boston?
Northeastern University.
Nice. Mm. Have you been following the rise of Northeastern? That it's become one of the most competitive schools in the country now. It is crazy.
It's a huge population of students. It's a huge urban campus.
It's a wonderful school, and I grew up wonderful school. But now the amount of students that are trying to get in, it's amazing. Okay, so you were in the practice space doing critical care physician assistant work.
I left there, went to New York City, was in the Bronx in surgery and critical care. Mm-hmm. Then worked in Lower Manhattan. Oh, yeah, it was amazing.
Were you at Albert Einstein? Where were you?
Albert Einstein and Montefiore. Yeah, yeah.
Hmm. Wow, our worlds. We got to talk afterwards. Because I also went from Boston to the Bronx and was volunteering in Albert. Okay, all right, go on. It's not about me, though. Somehow I make it.
It's not about you, Heather.
I know. I should have a radio show.
So, but no, and then I worked in critical care medicine at Beth Israel Medical Center in Lower Manhattan, and then became chief PA there of our division and within the department, and did that for a number of years. Did a lot of bedside teaching and working with different education programs, and moved on to hospice and palliative care. Quality improvement, because I was burned out from clinical practice.
I was
going to
say that's a big jump. Yeah. I mean, that is a how did that happen?
I was burned out, so I went to hospice.
I know. I'm like, wow.
That's a weird one, right?
It is, but I can't tell you how many people they say I need to retire, so I'm going to go retire to work at a retirement community, or I want to go into more thoughtful, you know, and especially because you were in emergency medicine and the intensity of that. So, that is an interesting. But I see it.
Yeah, I see it. And there's a line through this.
There
somewhere.
Is a line through it.
And then did that for a bit, and then directed a graduate program, a PA graduate program for a while I was finishing up my doctorate in public health.
Yay.
And then moved down to Durham and Duke and the VA down there. So down here.
So do you miss? I mean, we'll talk about what you do now. Do you miss not being at the bedside providing the kind of hands-on clinical care?
Or that fast pace of it.
The fast pace.
In that area.
Everything I do, well, now I kayak surf for fast pace. Oh. That's what I do. But everything I do now is informed by all those years of clinical practice.
Yes. Mm.
I cannot do the work that I do now in caregiving and serious illness space and so forth without having had done that, because I'm on research teams now where there's not a lot of clinicians and they don't really have that perspective.
And you say, I tell that to people all the time with my work privately with families, and I say, I liken it to clinician researchers, that being with families, I spent all morning texting with families, but working with families every single day informs then what I talk about on the radio, but really my work with the North Carolina Serious Illness Coalition. Mm-hmm. Because, the program and policy work, when you see what's really happening on the ground level with folks.
It's the exposure. I think that exposure is relative. Mm-hmm. You're not just coming in with...
Keeps me grounded.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So tell us about your work then. So you do have so many different, we give you a hard time, but how do you divide your time between your research work and your teaching work? Mm-hmm. Like, how does that and your advocacy and your writing? We'll get into your writing. Both. There's a whole other thing. Nathan does a lot of writing through his work, but you also have personal blogs. So
yeah, I wrote a lot of op-eds and so forth.
Yes.
The current administration is fodder for that. So rich.
It is very rich. It is. So how do you split your time?
I would say I have a symbiotic relationship with my teaching and my research.
Okay.
I bring my research into my classroom. The classroom instruction helps me really solidify my thinking around my research. So there's a symbiosis there.
Okay.
The things that fall outside of that and suck brain power away are things like administrative tasks, which I've actually stepped down from a few items recently to provide more time for me to do teaching and research.
I was wondering that, because when I was looking at it, I remember there were some other roles there, but yeah, that's just going to pull you away. I want to ask about your teaching. And the reason why I want to ask about your teaching first is I think we'll go deeper into your research. And so just from a teaching, what are the types of things you teach? And then we'll go into your...
Sure. Each year for the undergraduate public policy students, I teach an introduction to U.S. healthcare systems course, an overview of our non-system of care here in the United States. For most of my teachings in the graduate level programming. So for that, I teach organizational ethics, a course every spring that I created 7-8 years ago and teach every spring.
Fodder for that.
I teach qualitative research methods every fall. Also a course that I created and teach every fall, just about. From time to time, I teach a managed care and health insurance course as well.
Whoa. All right. So I can see... These students, I would think, would love them. Those are very, you're not saying probably read this thing, you know, you're not resting on your laurels. We're like, okay, read this textbook from 25 years ago. These are evolving issues.
I have not assigned a textbook in the last 15 years of 19 years of teaching. So,
yeah, I could see that, though. I do have a book for you.
I use resources. Don't get me wrong.
It's not a textbook.
But I don't generally use textbooks.
Yeah, because my dad wrote the book, like, The History of U.S. Health Policy or
I'm
something.
Aware,
but it was not
Heather.
A textbook. Yeah, I know, right?
I've got to plug that.
Do a little plug for my dad,
right,
just in case he's listening. But, yeah, we'll make sure I can get you a signed
what
copy.
What level of student are you teaching?
For the undergraduate course, it's all those who are in a four-year degree program.
18, 19.
Can their brains handle that?
Do they all want to be pre-med is what I'm thinking.
It's a big pre-med school, Duke University is. I tried to disabuse them of that sort of you know, little narrow version of how to help in healthcare. I tell them, if you're a policy wonk, healthcare is the place for you. If you're a data nerd, healthcare is the place for you. If you like to work with icky patients, because sometimes they're icky, and I love that myself, then healthcare is the place for you. And it's 19% of our GDP. If you want to get into that, there's a place for every personality.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, I love that. And so you work with undergrads, but then a lot of you, to answer for Alicia's question.
Yep, graduate, public policy.
I just can imagine their brains coming in at 18, 19 years old and handling this deep.
You'd be surprised. I've been the caregiver for my mother who has MS since I was 12. That's the story. First day, I'm really happy to learn about Medicaid.
Okay, that's
my family's been on Medicaid for years. Now I understand, like, what that's about.
And I know, I'll name drop. So my dad will ask. My dad teaches an undergraduate class. And he right after I graduated from the same university, he started teaching it in the 90s. And it became the top 10 classes you have to take at Brandeis. And it was his overview. And he would ask the students, how many of you had an MRI? And he was shocked at how many people had had it, you know. And so even just their own personal experiences, he'd be like, holy crap, I didn't realize all of you were so sick. And it's just because so many, and so even just the complexities that they've gone through. So
part of me is a little bit lazy. And then the other part of me just recognizes people's lived experience. So I capitalize on that in every class, right? I bring in their lived experience because why should I be talking the whole time, right? You know, there's great material right there sitting in front of me. Folks have things to say, things they're itching to say oftentimes, and they can share that with us and we can all learn.
And I'm glad you brought up the caregiving, this issue about younger folks, younger kids, a huge issue of kids under 18 that are caregivers. And so by the time they get to school, my daughters could say the same thing with my mom, you know, helping me take care of my mom. And so, yeah, they've seen a lot of stuff and now they can make sense.
You don't think that.
We're going to have our
living in a now. But you don't think that on average.
No, you don't think that. So but it's my job as a professor to do well by them and draw that out.
So then how go into the work, because I could just spend all the time. I love those classes and I want to, but I know that it's so rich, your research work. And I am curious about that. And also how you decide which of, there's so many topics you go into. I mean, I was looking at your, you know, even at your website, and I like how you use intersection of social care and healthcare, but there's just so many issues in healthcare administration and medicine and hospice palliative care and quality improvement and caregiving. How do you decide Is it whoever pays you first?
Well, I mean, in the current and previous funding environments, what does pay as a researcher is important. Mm-hmm. You can't ignore that.
And that's what we do in America. Come on.
Yeah, but at the same time, I'm fortunate in that I've generally been able to study the things that I find important and do want to study. So I would say there's things I would divide into buckets. A big one is caregiving, right?
Yes.
Family caregiving, and when I say family caregiving, that's inclusive of friends and neighbors, because that's usually the sort of the matrix, the tapestry that's cobbled together for so many of our older folks and those living with disabilities in America, because we actually don't have a very cohesive system of care at that latter age, latter end of life. Another big area is, again, and older adults, but in the post-incarceration space. So upon reentry,
I was like, "That's
from
a big
prison.
Word." Yeah, from prison.
Yeah.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah.
About your work. Okay.
Lots of stigma to overcome there for jobs and getting
and that's
housing
for
and
older adults or.
I focus on older adults.
Okay, is that over 65? 80?
Well, so that's a really good point. You played right into my hand on that one, because when I study the older adults, but in the post-incarceration space, studies have shown that 55 is more like the 60. You know, 55 is the new 65 for those who have been in prison.
Wow.
In short, right? I mean, it ages you. So, so when I do studies like that, I'm doing a study right now where it's a series of focus groups looking at 55 and older that informed a national survey. A statewide survey of reentry council leaders. We're just getting some of that survey data in right now. But in those focus groups, we explored the lived experience of those who are 55 and older. And that was important for that study because you do have sort of this accelerated aging in prison. But mostly 65 and older is what I focus on.
And I would think, and then the complexity is, while there is a safety net that starts to kick in at 65, thanks to Medicare and some of the Medicaid support for older adults, that, and I see that in the community, even for the non-incarcerated population, that 55 to 64 group can be really struggling, because a lot of folks, especially communities of color, where there may be onset of debilitating disabilities and diseases, and yet there's a safety net that hasn't kicked in yet. Interesting. Okay, so that's the second bucket.
Another bucket are those paid workers that are working out in the community, often in people's homes, such as certified nursing assistants, home health aides, right? And so I'm funded by the state Medicaid program to lead now in our fourth year a program to recognize and identify the struggles happening there for direct service workers and professionals in people's homes out in the community. And we just finished a pilot program looking at education, then doing peer-led communities of practice to try to build a base of supports peer-to-peer. I look at that issue. Another sort of paid but community-based caregiving idea is community health workers. In about a month and a half, I start a very large VA randomized clinical trial looking at using community health workers out in rural communities to work with caregivers of older, seriously ill veterans. So community health workers is another sort of paid caregiving role that I look at.
This is so amazing, and I was trying to be quiet so you could the listeners could hear more. So much of what I do, especially with the Serious Illness Coalition and in my work with aging, it does come down to not just the family and friend caregiver network, but that paid caregiver. And I'm loving that you are working on raising awareness and identifying the struggles, because it is so intense, and you have so many great people doing the hardest work with very little money, very little compensation, very little recognition. And as a family caregiver myself, and I have also worked in the paid caregiving space with retirement communities, and then now with my own family and others, that partnership, I wrote a love affair, my love affair with the caregiver, and that intersection between family caregiving and the paid caregiving world is so powerful. So anyway, thank you for that. And I want to dive into that more. But all right, you're still going. The community health workers, I could so see Alicia.
I just was
That's going to be Alicia's thing.
How do you find a way in? How are you? I know you said
North Carolina has a 96-hour state standard curriculum that's offered at least 8 different community colleges, either online or in person, and they've been doing that now for about 5-7 years maybe, and they're ahead of the curve.
For community health workers?
For the CHW certification.
Because I was just talking with a group that focuses on volunteer caregiving, and just a few days ago, the Volunteer Respite Consortium, and they were talking about what is the good training out there for volunteers, because it's they don't want to do hands-on like the CNA training, but I gotta look into that.
Look into it. It's
Alicia, you gotta do it.
Underwritten by the state. I think it's only about, I don't want to quote numbers for the community college, you know, tuition prices,
manageable.
But it's quite affordable.
Okay, let's look into that. All right. Any other buckets before we go deeper into some of them here?
Like, it's so affordable that. Like, I'll give you the money for it.
That's
not a broad invitation to your audience, but listen,
Dr. Nathan Boucher has just started. He just announced on the Aging Well Together show a special foundation where he will offer stipends for anyone interested in the community health workers program.
We can make it happen. How about that?
We'll make it happen. Listeners, you email me if you're interested, and I will give you his number. But I love that. Okay, so community health workers, so important, especially in our rural areas.
Yes, absolutely. And then the other bucket I would say, if I really had to limit myself, would be mostly on the VA side, and that is working with VA operations partners to try to help with improving quality and streamlining processes within health systems, because in the VA, there's 171 medical centers. There's 1,300-plus diagnostic and outpatient centers. Mm. We serve 9.1 million veterans or so, plus family members. It is an enormous healthcare system.
And people, it takes its punches from the media and from folks, and some of it absolutely deservedly so. But when I talk with folks, I think people are unaware of, maybe they even catch how big the VA system may be from a healthcare, but how much it does to improve research, to look into quality. Mm-hmm. I know when I was doing some work with telehealth, it was like, oh, the most innovative folks right now, it's coming out of the VA, because they do have a system to test things, to pilot things, to fund it. And then the rest of us benefit from that learnings.
Absolutely.
That was an interesting word.
Absolutely.
So.
If every health system had to go quarterly before Congress and report how they've done, they would also be on the front page of the newspaper potentially, because when you're dealing with complex patients, a large patient population, working on it's a large budget, but for what they have to do, it's not a very, very rich budget. They have to report what the things they do well and the things they could improve on, and it turns out actually that the VA actually exceeds most non-government facilities on most metrics. Satisfaction is very high in the VA. And again, I'm not reporting official data here for the Veterans Administration, but just as a VA researcher, we work in a complex system that actually does really well by veterans.
It's just, I think when you start to hear it, for people, it's getting into the system is complex, the wait times and things like that. But no, it can, a shout out. We've had a few shows that highlight
the veterans
different programs, especially caregiving programs. Mm-hmm. So out of all that, what's your favorite? But
don't make me do that.
I won't do that. One of the things you have done, and it inspires me, and I want this to come out. I don't want this to come out as an insult. I want it to come out as a compliment, because it's supposed to be. I'm always impressed at your level of outreach when it comes to writing down your findings or your observations. So we'll get into your personal observations and your blogging separately. But as a researcher and as a public health advocate and voice, I'm not a researcher, but I'm have some public health criteria myself. I'm always impressed when I see what you're writing about and your commentaries and even your research. And to me, I look at writing as so heavy and intense, and it has to go so long, and you have to be overly so professional sounding that people are like, what are you actually talking about? And you write really some nice, short, accessible pieces.
Facts.
Yeah, there's kind of like, this fact happened, but what does this mean? Mm-hmm. And you inspire me in it's just like, oh, you can write and be published and get things out there that are just
understandable.
Yes.
We need to understand.
That's coming out as a compliment, right? Not an insult. Right. But I was like, you know, it's easy to understand for us. And
need.
I think we need that. And I've been so impressed for years. And I even think, well, if Nathan can do that, I can do that. That's where. So that was a really long way of trying to say you're out there, like you're learning things, but I feel like you spent equally as much time to share it
in a way that we can interpret it, because all that high end people need to know coming right at you direct.
Even the papers that now go out into journals that we publish need to be written in a more layperson kind of term. It used to be that you would publish in a journal and it would get mailed out to the, you know, society membership that was attached to that journal.
Yes.
Medical
now you don't really have to be part of that society and so forth. You can sort of get a PDF, you know, sent to you or texted to you. And it's kind of things make their way around in a more fluid way. And you have all sorts of audiences listening who are not experts, you know. And so I think whatever we can do to put stuff in plain language, even in the academic sphere or publication. But I also, as you mentioned, do a lot of op-ed writing, and that is meant to be accessible.
Well, and I, much to my family's dismay, I spend a lot of time watching news programs on channels that people don't expect me to watch. I try to watch a full complement of news channels, so all the way from CNN to Newsmax and Fox and then your network. So I like news. I actually love seeing how people talk about the same issue but in very different ways. And this issue that has come up time and time again is the inability to just speak clearly. So I'll just say it. So a lot of the strength of the Republican and strategists that come out is really easy to understand language.
Oh, sure.
And that the overly, and I represent the coastal elite, right? You know, heavily academic background from the coast, both in New England and down here in North Carolina. But this this writing and creating barriers just by the way we talk about thing. And I think, so when I watch Newsmax and Fox News and talk, I'm always impressed with the clarity of messaging.
Absolutely.
Whether you agree or not. And there's a lot to be learned. There's a lot the ivory tower. And I'm not trying to get paid as an academic, but you are. And so it is also like, are there discussions internally? Like, yeah, that's great. You put this peer-reviewed paper out there with like crazy amounts of big words, but nobody's understand. I mean, I've had to read some of these, and I have to read it over and over again. Like, what are they actually saying?
And I think even the, some of those journals want to have little synopses in the beginning, some bullet points, like, so what? The who cares?
Yeah. So what? I had a boss that would say it all the time, and she wasn't being mean. She was like, okay, but so what? I have to say, and I know this is controversial, but this is where ChatGPT has gotten really, really helpful.
Oh, sure.
Because it's like, hey, summarize this. Right. Put this into, make this cleaner, make this clearer.
Right.
So, and that's a whole other issue, because I would not want to be in your shoes, teachers, these days.
Oh, my goodness.
Don't fight it. Just welcome it in.
Oh, no. I use it as a tool
in
the classroom. Yeah.
Well, and the students, it'd be like, yeah, use ChatGPT. But
the university sponsors it. In July, they opened up a whole suite of ChatGPT-related, you know, those types of AI-related services to students.
Yeah, you can't fight. I have two girls in college. My one of my best friends is a high school teacher. And, you know, when you try to fight it, you know, and oh, that's an honor code violation. It's like, well, then figure out a way to teach with it. Hey, how does ChatGPT? And then basically, like, my daughter had to do a test old school, like Blue Books. Remember when you just walk in and you have to write it? And I think that's how you're going to have to do more things that are in person, or they're writing it, or do videos, something that's not just do a paper.
My neighbor out the window.
Really? I was telling Nathan how fun and distracting it is when people...
I don't want to identify him, but...
No, we... hi! Did he see you?
I don't know if you're...
But he saw me and Alicia. He waved, and it is funny.
I wave at everybody if it goes by.
My colleague, and it may be a colleague of yours, passed by, and I waved her. She didn't see me, so I called right after the show. I'm like, what? You don't look into a random window of a studio and see? So... All right. So going back, talk about your writing, because we do have a little bit of time left. How you decide, because you do talk about your personal writing and your op-ed pieces that you write. And how is that, A, how do you not get in trouble? But also, how does that infuse, like, where's, is there a line between what you're writing
censorship.
About? I find with my stuff, the line's totally blurred now. And again, because I'm doing, like, what's the line between professional observations and personal ones?
Personal opinions.
I mean, I try not to get too political. I try to focus on the policies. Mm-hmm. I try to focus on the facts. I do it either as a individual person or with my Duke affiliation, not with any other affiliations.
But do you have to get permission? Because even that... Okay.
No, you know, and it's not like, you know, you submit something to an editor of a newspaper and, you know, 9.5 times out of 10, you don't get a response. But, you know, so the yield is not very high. But they're flooded, right? They're flooded with all sorts of opinions.
I submitted something 2 months ago on family caregivers and the importance of. A group helped us write it, and a few of us submitted it, and nothing. And I think, like, the next day, some huge catastrophe happened in the world, and so the media wasn't going to do it.
Too much competition. Yeah, too much news competition.
But when you write it, do you then put it on your own website, or do, because, like, no words written wasted? I just made up a whole new
I mean,
group.
I...
That was a good bumper sticker for an academic. No words written wasted.
Nice.
Okay.
No, I do not have a personal blog. I do not have a personal website.
So wait, the things you sent me, the pieces you've sent me, I need to go back to them because I was paying attention to the content. I wasn't paying attention to where they were posted.
Yeah, they're all newspapers or other organizations that accepted it.
Aren't you scared people are going to yell at you?
I have gotten, let's just say I've had to block people on my email, yes.
Okay.
Because they reached out. Even when my email hasn't posted, they hunted me down on the, because you can get it on the Duke website.
Sure.
And I've there's been a lot of rude comments, but at least you know you're reaching folks.
Well, yeah.
Well, because we,
that's all right.
We talked about that with Representative Alan Boynsey last week, who was on the show, and you've said how great he is. He's amazing talking to your students.
Absolutely.
And I was like, how do you put yourself out there and not get scared about being canceled or all the things they'll find? I realize the irony, me asking this on a public radio show, but I'm assuming our listenership is so small, and whoever's listening are people who generally know us and like
people
us.
People in all over the world.
So I'm going to get myself canceled, but I have very thin skin. So I have to say, I'm a little worried about writing things and annoying people. And then other things, I feel like there are things I'm starting to write, and I'm like, if I'm annoying you, well, then... maybe that's good, because now I'm writing things about encouraging people to do proactive planning and thinking through things and helping their families out by giving documents. Like, if I'm annoying you, it's just because you don't want to think about it. Right. I don't think I'm saying anything.
Uncomfortable truths.
Yeah. Uncomfortable truths. But
different opinion. I mean, welcome to America.
So at the end of the day or in the middle of the day, how do you decide, okay, I want to write up my research findings or I want to kind of slam this new policy?
Well, I mean, I would say that the approach I take is not slamming, and I think that's the key.
Well, that's a good point.
I'm not trying
to get canceled because I'll ask questions oddly. Go on.
I'm not trying to be bombastic. I'm not trying to rile people up. If I write an opinion in a newspaper and they accept it, it's I think this is problematic, and here's why.
Yes.
And here are some links to some resources that kind of back up what I'm saying. I don't know that I'm in the business of trying to shock people. I think I can state proudly and firmly my disagreement with something without trying to call names or something like that.
And I think, and I want to go into some of your caregiving work, and I think that's my issue a little bit, is that I want to get people's attention on some things, and I find that being more provocative will get their attention. So I just, as an example, I started years ago.
That's probably true, but that's not really the business I'm in.
True, but I'll tell you my provocativeness. Mm-hmm. Just so that sounds really funny. But so years ago, I was talking to a group of graduate students who were looking into in public health. And so these are the types of things that I was talking about, caregiving and the reality of caregiving. And I said, and there was a woman there who is a writer, and I was like, feel free to use this. But when it comes down to caregiving and people really thinking through, oh, when everyone's like, I want to stay at home or I'll just take care of my parents. And I said, okay, but are you prepared to see your parents naked?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's what I mean by provocative.
Oh, sure.
Is sort of
But it's an uncomfortable truth.
It's an uncomfortable truth. Go. So that's what I mean. So it's not. It just is. And that got their attention. They're like, oh, that's a good name of an article. So rather than titling it, oh, the challenges related to caregiving or things to think about, top 10 things, I'll be like, are you prepared to see your parents naked? And let's go from there. But going into your research, but also because with our few minutes left, I want to talk about your depth into community-based work.
Mm-hmm.
Because you do bring in, as the official term, the lived voices, the personal experiences that you get out of the ivory tower in service of the ivory tower, in service of research, you go out into the community. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, one thing that I do regularly is build right into a proposal. If I'm asking somebody for money to do some sort of research, I say, I am going to have a community advisory board.
Mm-hmm.
This community advisory board is going to be made up of caregivers, of patients, of people with serious illness, veterans, whatever the topic might be, as well as frontline folks like social workers, mm-hmm. chaplains, that people who can really have an aggregate lived experience, who can say, yes, I've seen 200 people mm-hmm. that kind of experienced this hardship in the community. And I assemble those folks on an advisory board, and they advise me. They keep me on the rails with research tools, feedback on the data, things like that. So I think that really keeps us grounded in the community. We do a lot of things that we might call listening sessions with mm-hmm. community members, and we try to compensate people for that. So if it's really off of
that's
a grant, I say, hey, you know, folks will get $25 for showing up mm-hmm. To an hour long listening session,
mm-hmm.
maybe more if we have it in the budget. So I think involvement, compensation, honoring the voices, and speaking less, I try to do, because like you, Heather, I like to talk as well. But I think a real key is allowing that kind of open space for folks to even have that pause in silence when people. I just finished doing a focus group on a project a few days ago, and I said, listen, folks, I have two kids, two dogs, two cats. I have a loud house. You want to have a little silence here during the focus group? Oh, this is wonderful. And that sort of allowed folks to kind of have a laugh, but also to think a bit mm-hmm. about what they might say next.
I took a beat. I do not like I like silence when I'm all alone. When I'm all, I love silence. I can spend hours on my own. I put music on sometimes TV, but I can do silence. It really bothers me, and that's the extrovert in me or the whatever. When I'm with three people or more, and when I'm with other people and silence, and I have to sort of, if I put a question out there, especially if I'm facilitating a focus group, it is so hard for me because I'm like, there's so many people. Or if they ask a question to a group of people and nobody says anything, I'll wait. And after about 10 seconds, if nobody says anything, which is a long amount of time, I'm like, all right, I'll say something. But I love the idea about not just honoring voices from a lip service, because you sometimes do, and I've had to answer for researchers when I've gone and done my community work, and people have said to me, you know, these college folks, they come in and we're their guinea pigs. You just come and tell us what's wrong, or you use all the time, you know, and we're sick of being studied, or we're sick of being told what's wrong, mm-hmm. and so really honoring the voices. I'm doing some research work now. That issue of compensating all the churches and community organizations get a $500 stipend for mm-hmm. participating, really honoring their time, and so I love that. But that you really use it, and I've seen some of the proposals and helped with a few of them, and your effort to get beyond even the triangle and go into more rural areas of North Carolina.
That's my focus lately is rural America, rural North mm-hmm. Carolina. And after the big, beautiful bill, rural areas are even more at risk than they ever were. So, yeah, that's a big focus of mine.
I know. So then how can folks get involved. So you've got Alicia right here, who's the, what's the word? I'm looking for a big word. Consummate community volunteer. She'll join, she'll volunteer for, you know, she's an ombudsman, she's a surveyor, she's an educator, Meals on Wheels, an election worker. So if you, and actually an advisory board member would be wonderful if you only need her for one time.
Yeah, but I'm on the boards. I mean,
she's, yeah, you're a little board crazy. You need like one and two time things. So specifically, how can Alicia get involved? Or how can others get involved if they're
how do you bring your community in? And compensation is one of the best.
When we can do it, that is the way to do it.
Or even food. Just like food. If people are coming in, feed them. Mm-hmm. I used to have a whole slide on the power of cookies. And that was just to bring other, like,
for,
that's how you'll get me. Listeners, if you want me to come over somewhere,
food
feed.
And money. Especially rural.
Right.
Honey, they'll come out for a fresh, you know, honey.
Oh, yeah.
She's giving them.
Fish.
All right. Well, I don't want to come out for fish, but I will come out for a pig pickin or spaghetti or fried chicken. So what, how do you bring in, how can people, like, do people just reach out to you or is it more tailored, like, all right, we're doing this specific thing in this community?
There's kind of two different kinds of volunteers that I've noted. It's those who have a passion about a particular, say, chronic disease or problem in the community. And there's others who don't care so much about the particular thing, but maybe you're a young person trying to build a resume or get involved or they just want to lend a hand.
I have I have a lot of interns from the Serious Illness Coalition and they're like, yeah, I just both building a resume, want to get involved, and they've experienced things and trying to make
sense. And there's nothing wrong with that.
In fact,
that's a great sort of, you know, overlap of things.
Love
is you have some passion, but you also have a little bit of a carrot or, you know, in front of you that you want to build, you know, your CV or your resume. So that's a great thing to have in the mix. So I would say that being able to find something that you're truly interested in and want to commit to, and 1 hour a week is, you know, better than nothing, right? And maybe that's the better balance for your life anyway, because we all have to work and take care of our families and so forth. So I used to be a big volunteer person, and I don't do it that much volunteering. I'm just kind of too busy.
Right.
And I do hope to get back to more of that. I think my work is my passion right now.
That's how I feel. Any of the places when I got full-time salary and benefits corporate and all
America.
Those, but when I became a gig worker, when I became a consultant and family members and colleagues said, you got to stop giving away for free. And so I try to work and be in the space where I would volunteer anyway. And then through the work, even if I'm going to events, like I went to an event last night, I wasn't paid to go to it, but I found three phenomenal people I want to bring on the radio show. So it links back in some way
to the passion of what you're doing,
to the things that we're doing.
Volunteering is in us. You're going to do it even when you're not doing it.
Oh, sure.
Because you're going to meet people. They're going to connect.
So for folks, we have 3 minutes left. For folks, and I've got, how can people reach out to you or how can they learn more? You know, should they go to a Duke website to learn more about you and your work? And then I've got a fun closing question.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, my duke.edu email is open 24/7 to receive messages.
Is it like
whether or not I get back to you is a whole other question.
You're pretty good though. Is it like Nathan.Boucher?
It is Nathan.Boucher, Boucher, at duke.edu.
Fantastic. And so, wait, were you going to say anything else? You were thinking?
No. No.
See, look, I took a quick moment, but it was all right. So I want to ask you, especially in your research, and I'm excited about just the emerging themes or what are the issues specifically. And, you know, my passion area is around caregiving on both the family caregiving end and the direct care caregiving end and anything involving serious illness. What are like the top few big trends or issues that you feel like we, or especially those of us that are in the sort of practice and advocacy world you think we should be focusing on?
Family caregiving is always at the top of my list. It's where the support, the money, the recognition should be going. I just had a piece come out in Chapelboro Viewpoints online that was about a national service, sort of mandatory year of national service where everybody can you could do the military if you wanted to, sure, but how about other community based things like work as a CNA for a year in people's homes? That is where our major shortage is. And you could really do a world of good, get some job experience as a young person, build your resume, make connections. I would love to see a national service requirement that's, you know, a year. But not necessarily the military, right? I mean, that because that scares people, right?
But well, it's like the AmeriCorps or the Internal Peace Corps, Teach for America, you know, all of these. I love that.
But a focus on home and community-based services would be really great. So I would say caregiving and recognizing caregiving, but also those paid caregivers in the homes, like nursing assistants and so forth. That the problem with that is that I'm working on supporting them and creating peer support and education programs related to that. However, we always come up against they're not getting paid enough.
They're not.
Hourly wage, and that is connected to Medicaid because almost all long-term care services and supports are paid through Medicaid or private pay, not Medicare. That is the myth. It's Medicaid, and Medicaid is not a very financially strong program, and there are 50 different state versions of it with various menus for each, right? And so that taking care of mom or dad at home is being done by folks who often are on Medicaid themselves because they qualify to be so because it doesn't pay very well that job or several jobs they might have to make ends meet. So so I would say we need to focus on the unpaid family type caregiving and another big focus on the paid, though not paid well, caregiving that's happening by home care workers.
I think that's huge, and I work on this every single day with clients and in my own life. And the issue is sometimes the families actually are paying quite a bit, but they're paying it to. And I love my agency friends that are running them. I'm going to go see some of them. But the way that things are created, the actual caregiver gets very little of it. And so there's also this disconnect between when families are paying even, you know, $35 an hour, $40 an hour. Which is not but much more than the $15 an hour that people are trying, but the caregiver themselves aren't receiving it, and that's when I think it gets there's also that disconnect because families are like, I thought I was paying well.
I think the national average for that type of worker is around $12, $12.70, something
it
like
is.
That.
So. And so is a family member. So, all right, well, let's end on a positive note, which is look how wonderful it was having a Duke person on the show today. But no.
Not only that, but.
Yeah. Dr. Nathan Boucher, thank you so much.
I live in Chapel Hill.
I know. There this is where you get. Yeah. He is part of us. And you didn't even. I tried to give you the opening, but I didn't. I talked too much. You have an adjunct appointment over at UNC in the School of Pharmacy, right?
I do.
And yeah, you pay taxes. And so we are.
My wife went to school at UNC.
That was it. I knew there was something about
degree.
I knew there was something about your wife.
For your part.
But. Really, thank you so much. Thank you for being here, but really for your work, which inspires me and now hopefully will inspire our listeners. Thank you to WCOM for letting us use this wonderful studio. Thank you to Orange County Department on Aging for sponsoring the show. Alicia, as always, thank you for joining. And really, listeners, we really appreciate you being a part of this journey with us, and we will talk with you next week. All right, thanks.
Thank you.